Artist and RPI graduate Dr. Heather Dewey Hagborg spoke to WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer about art, DNA surveillance, and the commodification of our genetic profiles.
In 2012, I started collecting cigarette butts and chewed up gum and hairs from public streets and bathrooms and waiting rooms around New York City, and took them to community biology lab. Actually, the first in the world had just opened up down the street from me in downtown Brooklyn called GenSpace. And I worked with the scientists there to figure out how to extract DNA from these kind of forensic items that I was collecting from strangers. And then I started analyzing those and creating genetic profiles of the data that I could interpret from the samples. And then took that data and hooked it up to a morphable model, a kind of mathematical model of a face, and used that to parameterize different representations of what that stranger might look like based on genomic information, genomic research. And I would output those as 3D models and then print them using a 3D printer, but a full color one, so they would be printed as life-size sculptures in full color, and created these kind of ghostly portraits of strangers based on their DNA information. And I exhibit them along with the artifacts that they were created from and bits and pieces of information about where I found the sample and what I'd learned about the person.
What are things you can and can't tell about how somebody looks from their genetics?
Almost nothing is so clear-cut. So it's a very hard question to answer. It depends on how we think about certainty and how we think about truth and the construction of knowledge. So we can make guesses about people based on their genetic information. And you should always keep in mind that the genome is kind of like one-third of the picture about a person. So you have the genome, that's a third. You have the epigenome, that's another third. And then you have the environment, that's another third. I think it's pretty safe to say that the best you can get in that guess is like a third of a person.
Epigenetics has become a pretty advanced field of study in the last decade or so, and basically looks at the ways in which environmental interactions do have a chemical modification as well. And it's kind of like a layer on top of the genome that gets modified through
being in the world, so to speak. And there's also been some evidence that the epigenome can be inherited. So for example, when I looked at the regular genome, I could make inferences about people's ancestry or about their eye color or about their genetic sex, but I couldn't get any clue of how old they were. Whereas if I looked at the epigenome, which I didn't have access to in doing strange revisions research, then I could also start to estimate things like age.
When you started your project, DNA surveillance seemed like a dystopian fiction. But after reading your piece in The New Inquiry, it seems like we really should be concerned.
Yeah, exactly. So in about 2014, this company, Parabon Nanolab, launched a service that they called DNA Snapshot that was purporting to do basically exactly what I was doing semi-speculatively in Strange Revisions, but then offering it as a service to police. So for like thousands of dollars, you know, police around the country can now purchase these totally dubious DNA mugshots of alleged criminals from evidence they've left at crime scenes. It's concerning, I think, in particular, because if you take this really ambiguous profiling technology and put that in the hands of the police, it's really not hard to imagine that this becomes a new form of racial profiling and that it can seem to have some kind of authority of DNA. I mean, getting back to also our kind of popular ideas of DNA as this truth machine, that we think it is this perfect form of evidence and that it can tell all. And that can easily become conflated with this much more speculative approach of generating possible portraits of people based on this information. And so it does concern me that this will become more and more widespread, and that the public, including the police, I mean, I would include the police in the public, because it's not like they have special training, that they will think that it is more accurate than it is.
There's this terrible phrase I hear sometimes, that data is the new oil. Is it even useful to think of DNA as data?
Definitely. This is one of the things that I've been looking into in the past year or so, is biological commodification. So it's become very clear that these companies like 23andMe, these direct-to-consumer genetic profiling companies, where you basically pay $100 or $200 and order a kit and spit in it, send it back to them, and then they post a profile of you on their website. I mean, a private profile of you on their website, and you can get information about your ancestry and your predispositions for diseases sometimes, and like kind of quirky trait information. So it's become very clear that these companies are selling that data to pharmaceutical companies. They may well also be selling the samples themselves. I haven't read anything about that, so that's totally speculative on my part. They might just freeze them and keep them for internal tests or whatever. There's definitely an afterlife of these kinds of samples and this kind of data. And in addition to that, they also are available to the police upon request. So everyone becomes, I mean, millions of people who have already voluntarily opted into this kind of genetic profiling are by extension also now part of a kind of criminal database system.
I saw your exhibition of portraits of Chelsea Manning, and I think it was a wonderful installation in New York. And I understand you displayed it again in Berlin at the Transmediale Festival. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure, yeah. So I started working with Chelsea Manning in 2015 while she was still in prison. And she, at that point, was subject to this really harsh form of incarceration where no one could visit her that wasn't her immediate family, her lawyer, or a very few people who had known her before she was incarcerated. She was doing an interview through the mail with Paper Magazine, and they were interested in having some kind of visual representation of her to accompany the interview. And they remembered my work in Stranger Visions with creating DNA portraits and sent me an email out of the blue asking if I would be interested in making a portrait of Chelsea. Because she was subject to this harsh visitation policy, no one had seen her. There were no photographs of her. There were no real images of her since her sentencing, which was also the time of her gender transition in 2013. And so I realized it would be this really poignant opportunity to use this technology, which I was becoming more and more concerned about, for this kind of liberatory purpose, so for good. So to take this technology that was increasingly seeming to me to be a tool of oppression, I mean, it always seemed to me that way, but it was becoming really increasingly concerning for me, but to then reappropriate that tool and try to use it for good. The original two portraits of Chelsea that were created for the magazine had different gender parameters, essentially. So in one of them, I left the sex parameter out altogether. So it was this kind of androgynous or gender neutral portrait. And then that was exhibited side by side next to a portrait that was parameterized female. And I would put that in quotes because it's really meant also to question and call attention to our ideas that are kind of stereotypes around what a gendered face is supposed to look like. What is a female face? Then, I mean, to make a long story short, she had her sentence commuted by Obama, which was amazing, and it was forecast in this comic book that we'd written together, and at the end of the comic book imagines that we have an exhibition of her portraits, and she's able to come see them in person. And so when her sentence was actually commuted, kind of the first thing on my list was to make the exhibition actually happen. And so it worked out to do a show at Friedman Gallery in New York, thanks also to curator Roddy Schrock from iBeam. And for that, suddenly we had this 1,000-square-foot space and just these two portraits. So clearly we had an opportunity there to really expand our idea for this installation. And that's where it turned into 30 portraits. And it turned into this opportunity to show actually how much more diverse she could look based on the same exact data. So to present 30 different interpretations of the same genetic data, giving rise to very different and diverse portraits. And the portraits also were suspended as a kind of crowd of faces that hovered in the middle of the gallery at a kind of range of different human heights.
Related to iBeam, I understand you're working with them to create a new exhibition and symposium called Refresh. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, the kind of art and technology scene is really exclusionary and tremendously biased towards this kind of cis white masculinist art that is all about kind of technological triumph. At a certain point, I just got totally fed up with it and started a campaign along with the artist Addie Wagenknecht and her collective Deep Lab at the time called Kiss My Ars to call attention in particular to sexism at the Ars Electronica Media Arts Festival in Linz, Austria. And we kind of did that a couple times and then came out of it and felt like we wanted to do something proactive. So instead of just calling attention to the problem, we wanted to say, well, actually, you know what? We're just going to show you what you're missing. We're going to show you really this amazing work by all of these diverse artists that are working in art, science, and technology.
And in particular, the focus of the exhibition and symposium that will take place in collaboration with iBeam at the end of this fall or early next winter is called Refiguring the Future. And so Refiguring, inspired by Morishan Aliari's work on refiguring as a kind of decolonizing practice, and then applying that towards thinking out our ideas of the future, which have been so dominated by this kind of white male European idea or framing, and then to ask, well, what if we give other voices an opportunity to really envision different kinds of futures? Maybe that can help pull us through this, what feels to me like this tremendous lull right now of hopelessness and grappling with this turn to the right. So looking for new ideas and new ways of thinking about the future.
That was Heather Dewey Hagborg talking about biopolitics and art.